All right, let's look at the text, chapter 9, verse 1. And Jesus passed by, and he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And when he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva. And he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, Go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went his way and washed and came back seeing. Therefore the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind said, Is this not he who sat and begged? And some said, This is he. Others said, It is like him. And he said, I am he. Therefore they said to him, How were your eyes opened? And he answered and said, A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed and received sight. Then they said to him, Where is he? He said, I do not know. Okay, so now we have the story as it kind of sets here in front of us. Got some questions here, some things we can discuss. I mean, Jesus has demonstrated his power once again. We said before, this is the sixth sign that is recorded in John's account. And his act came as in response to the question of his disciples. You know, the question being, you know, why is this man blind? I guess I answered the first question, didn't I? Why were they asking? Or what were they asking? And basically, they wanted to understand the basis for blindness. Was it self-inflicted? You know, afflictions the direct result of sin? And so you think about that for a moment, and what would you say to that? I mean, people can ask that same kind of question today when they see someone who has just been, you know, inundated with difficulties in life, maybe, or sickness, or isn't it really tough when babies have problems? Or babies, well, this man was blind from his birth. And so the question here is that, did he sin? Or his parents? Since he was born blind, is it the fault of his parents? How would he answer that? What would you say?
You know, you can go back to Exodus, chapter 4, verse 11. You've got the conversation going between Moses and God. Mm-hmm. Okay, Moses going, I'm not eloquent of speech. Okay. And God tells him, you know, who made the mouth? Okay. But he also continues, who made the blind? Who made the mute? Who made the deaf? Okay, was it not me, God? Mm-hmm. So sometimes people are made and born
with affliction.
Suit God's purpose.
To suit God's purpose. I think that becomes a very important point here in this.
Sometimes it can be the consequence of sin.
Can be.
I mean, with babies, fetal alcohol syndrome. You know, they develop issues because their mother, you know, drank alcohol.
That's right.
I've heard of people drinking moonshine and making themselves blind. I don't know if that's a myth or not, but
yeah. Okay. What else, Les?
Well, I was thinking if you wanted to go really, really way back, if we were in the Garden of Eden, you know, when you were Adam and Eve, then there would not have been blindness. Mm-hmm. There wasn't these kinds of sicknesses and illnesses. Mm-hmm. And sin brought death into the world, and it brought a lot of other consequences. But as far as the baby, which many people, Calvinists, you know, and various others believe that babies are born sinners, no, that's of course not the case. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuances to the question, really. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated question because nobody thinks you know, and you're right that this is a reason that many people, unbelievers, put forth in their disbelief of either the existence of God or, you know, believe in the Bible, because it says, why this is not fair.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that some people are born with physical maladies? It's not fair. Why isn't everybody born perfect? And so there, you know, that's something that mankind is struggling with.
Sometimes physical affliction can be the result of certain laws of nature, just the way we are designed. And there's just certain other aspects of wisdom that can be important too. You don't stand in front of a moving train. We understand laws of nature are going to take place, you know, if we do such a thing as that. Sometimes there's genetic inheritance, where there is sickness that's passed generation to generation. There's human accidents that can happen. Sometimes there's affliction that takes place because of poor choices in life. Nadab and Abihu, we talked about them not too long ago. Because of their choices, there was some immediate consequence that afflicted them. God killed them. Uzziah, we talked about not long ago, King Uzziah, who disobeyed the will of God, was afflicted with leprosy, and God afflicted him that way. But we also know, too, that the prophet Ezekiel penned the words of God that, you know, a son does not bear the sins of the father does not bear the sins of the son. You know, so we see that separation that takes place there, too. And so it is a complicated question, I think, in many ways. Well, what does Jesus have to say? What is his point with it? Earl, do you want to make a point?
Well, I was just going to say that their question implies that he would have sinned prior to his birth.
Because he was born blind.
Yeah. Who's at fault here? Was he born blind? Was he born blind because of the sins of his parents or because of his sins?
Mm-hmm.
That implies that he would have sinned before he was born.
Mm-hmm.
Which is absurd.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
In this particular case, Jesus makes it clear what the situation is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what is that response? You know, if we're wondering why the man was blind, what does Jesus have to say about it?
It wasn't him or his parents, but that the works of God might be mm-hmm. made manifest.
Mm-hmm. So we see, you know, going along with some things Gary had to say here, that there is a greater purpose here that God has intended. It was neither his sins nor his parents' sins. You know, sorrows of life, as has been mentioned here already, I think this is an important point, should remind us of the devil's role versus God's role. And he goes back to the garden. I mean, man was made perfect and had all things perfect in the garden. Sin got in the way. And sin made some dramatic changes here. But what we come to a point, Earl, you want to
I was just going
to
say one thing about their question. Their question reminds me of Job's friends.
Yeah.
Job's friends automatically assume that Job's affliction is a result of his sin, which it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an accusatory question, though.
Mm-hmm.
And theirs is as well.
It's interesting to me how quickly Jesus deflects the question. No, not deflect. That's like not dealing with it. He moves on to the real point. Their question is, did he sin? Did the father sin? Jesus deals with that. And now we move on in the storyline to what is the real point of the lesson. You know, the miracle that takes place here, and some points that we can draw from that. And I think also you might think about, you know, the miracles of Jesus testify to the compassion of Jesus. I mean, we've seen before, you know, not just in John's account, but even more so in some of the other gospel accounts, the compassion of Jesus with regard to those who are sick and those who need healing. Go back to the book of Matthew for a moment. Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, around verse 35. Matthew chapter 9, verse 35. Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Jesus had come to teach. That was his purpose. The miracles, of course, confirmed the words, confirmed he was the Son of God. It's compassion that led to this. In chapter 14 of Matthew still, Matthew chapter 14, and let's see, verse 14, the feeding of the 5,000, which we read about in John's account. When Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them, and he healed their sick. Of course, there was a lot of teaching that went on in that episode too, we would later read. In John, or Matthew chapter 15, in verse 32, the feeding of the 4,000. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I do not want to send them away hungry, lest they faint and faint along the way. Just a point about his compassion. You know, certainly that has a role in the healing that takes place of the blind man here too. And then the miracles proved that he was the Son of God, that he had the power to deliver man, not just from physical infirmities or bondage. But the bigger point here, I think we've got to see, is that Jesus has the power not just to relieve physical maladies, but the bondage of sin. I think that's a point that has to be made as we get through this episode here just a little bit more, that Christ can not only overcome the devil by healing affliction, he overcomes Satan's power with regard to spiritual death. Yeah, and we see that truly when he rose from the grave. And so one of our questions then, what or who is this episode really about? Is it about the blind man? No, it's really not. It's not about the blind man. I mean, we're not trying to diminish the event that took place, because it's the event that takes place that helps us to see the one that we really need to be looking at, and that's Jesus. Jesus is the center point of what's going on. And so that's why when his disciples are asking the question, who sinned, this man or his parents? You know, Jesus is moving on from that pretty quick, because that's not the point. That's not where he's going. And so we think about it in a little more depth here. We think about them. Okay, so he tells the man, you know, go to the pool of Siloam. Make clay. Or Jesus made this clay and put it on his side. Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. Which brings about some other interesting questions. What was the healing? I mean, how did this take place? I mean, I've seen sometimes events where there are those who are preachers or priests, whatever they want to be called, who make some kind of a clay and put it on an infirmity or rub it on the eyes. Is there something special about the clay? I imagine if you watch TV evangelists enough, you'll find one of them that's selling some special clay that'll heal sickness. Is it the clay? Is it the water? I mean, what about the pool of Siloam? I mean, it was a noted place within Jerusalem. The water coming from the Gihon spring is what fed water into Jerusalem. What about the water? I mean, is it the water?
No, it's following
through
what Jesus commanded.
Yeah. Here, there's this aspect of obedience that has to really stand out here. You know, what about Naaman? Go dip 7 times in the Jordan. He was reluctant to do that. That just didn't seem like that was a significant enough event to heal a man of his stature. But when he was finally compelled to obey by his servants, and he obeyed what the prophet had told him to do, he was healed. And obedience is what stands out in this episode too. All right, some thoughts, comments?
That's an interesting part to me. I don't think there's an answer to it, at least I don't know the answer. Sometimes, many times, Jesus didn't do anything. He didn't touch him. The centurion, your son gets already healed, yep. The withered hand healed. But here, he's got a formula. You got mud and saliva, mm-hmm. and you go wash it. But that's not always the case. And I know when Jesus does something, he's teaching a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it is obedience in this case.
Yes.
I would say the lesson is sometimes there is a formula. Sometimes God does say that if you do this, this will result in
it. Go dip 7 times.
Exactly. What if the man had not gone to wash in the asylum? Did any of us think?
He'd still have mud on his face. and he still couldn't see. It's just like Naaman. If he had not gone to the Jordan River, what if he dipped only six times? That's not what he was told to do. And so, you see, the more I've read this over, the more I've maybe get a little bit of understanding, I think, than what I've had of the power of obedience that is what is standing out here. You know, the real issue was not about, did he sin or did his parents sin? That's not really the point. Jesus dealt with that, you know, and gave an answer to that, but that's only like two verses of the whole text. That wasn't really the point. He dealt with it. He moved on. You know, and then, you know, here's what he told the man to do. And also, too, like in verse 5, verse 4 and verse 5, I must work the works of him who sent me while it's still day, for night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Remember, he just said that in the last chapter. I mean, it's still kind of a continuation of this context. I mean, we have moved here from inside the temple courtyard. We're outside of the courtyard somewhere, but it seems to me as though this is a continuing story. And he's still making that point. You know, it's like night is coming, but I am the light of the world. What is that supposed to mean? Night is coming.
Time is short.
You know, time is short. There's work that as long as I'm the light of the world. As long as I'm here, I'm the light of the world. There's work that's got to be done.
Well, I had a thought about this as I was reading over it. I wonder if he's speaking about the cessation of miracles. Because as long as he is in the world,
yes. He
is the light of the world. Night is coming when no man can work. Now, obviously, you know, throughout the apostles. But I wonder if there might be some sort of sense here that's...
I never even thought about that. That's an interesting thought, Rick. I didn't even thought about that. But what you're saying is true. You know, I mean, he did give his apostles the ability to carry on and do miracles to confirm the world, but that was going to be short term. That was only for a season, for a time. That's a good, interesting point. So what about this pool of Siloam again? This has been interesting to me to think about just a little bit, because there would be some, I'm sure, who are going to try to make the point that, I mean, just like there are those today who want to go to the Jordan River to be baptized, you know, as though there's something special about the water of the Jordan. And like we've talked before, I've seen the water of the Jordan. It's not so special looking. You know, it's...
We also went to the Pool of Siloam.
That's right. Yeah, what's so special about that?
Yeah, and there were plenty of other pools around that.
That's right. Jerusalem had other pools too. Why the Pool of Siloam? You know... Which makes me think that when Jesus came out of the temple and he saw the blind man, perhaps he came out of this side of the temple somewhere. I mean, on the other side of the pool, it's right on the other side of the temple. There's another pool, remember?
Bethesda.
Yeah, it's on the other side. And it was a large pool. You know, why didn't he tell him to go there? There was another healing that took place there. But he said to go to, you know, in this case, the Pool of Siloam. Now this is a model, you've seen this model before. Of first century Jerusalem. It is a model in the Israeli Museum. And at least it kind of gives us a perspective, a little bit of what some things may have looked like. And so from this is the temple mound right here, and this would be the ancient city of David. This is down here. And this area here is the Pool of Siloam. How do we know that the Pool of Siloam would be in that area? And how do we know that? What fed? How did the Pool of Siloam become filled with water? Well, it came from the Gihon Spring. But the Gihon Spring is not here. Oops, that's the wrong way. It's not here. It's up here somewhere. Remember the tunnel? Hezekiah's tunnel.
All 1,770.
You remember every, as Gary called it, hesitation tunnel. He wasn't going to go through that thing at first, but he did. You can walk through the tunnel all the way through, and you come out, you know, right down here. And we can easily determine that. You can see that. You can walk right through it. Another view right here, and this is not a very good picture. It's the best I could come up with. Looking at the city of Jerusalem today, and you can see the Temple Mount, the wall. This here would be like the ancient city of David as it is today. And when you look at this point A right there, which you obviously can't see it, but it's we'll look at some closer pictures here in a moment, is a traditional pool of Siloam. I'm going to show you some pictures of that in a minute, and you'll recognize it if you've looked at any pictures of Jerusalem before at all. And the location B shows some excavations that's being done today that reveals a little bit more about the size of the pool of Siloam. And I'm really hoping that this will make sense. Some of you have seen pictures of this before. This has long been identified as the pool of Siloam. And I've often thought, like, you know, it's not very big. I mean, several years ago, this is all that I could ever bring up as far as what was the pool of Siloam. And of course, what we have to remember, and we've talked about this some before, the city of Jerusalem, as we see it and know it today, is built on top of centuries worth of other cities of Jerusalem, so to speak. I mean, you can tell that, like, we're at the street level. This picture is from the street level, looking down at the pool of Siloam. And this being the tunnel where you come out of Hezekiah's tunnel. That's where you come out. And so, yeah, pretty easy to kind of determine that, okay, that's the pool of Siloam, but that's not all of it they know now. It actually goes on beyond this. It was a large pool. But it's only been in the last 10 years or so that there's been excavations done on the other side of the road that has helped them to know that this just fed in to the pool. And of course, this area here may have been bigger too. I mean, through the centuries, Jerusalem keeps getting built up. In fact, this was completely covered over at one time by a Byzantine church, which would probably have been 3rd or 4th century that was built. And this is still some of the foundations, I understand, in that Byzantine church of long ago. And so you get a picture of this right here. Here's where you come out of the tunnel, out of Hezekiah's tunnel. Now, if you're standing in the tunnel looking out, this is what you're seeing. And when I first saw that, several years ago, I looked at some pictures like this, and I thought, I would have thought that pool to be bigger than that. I just did not understand that Jerusalem is just built on and built on and built on. And very often, when there is something that is found of significance, you're not seeing the whole thing. And certainly with the pool of Siloam, it's that way. But this is what you see when you come out of that tunnel. And you notice across the way, you see the stairs that are going up. And I wish the street level is way up here, because it's pretty high. You go quite a few stairs to get up to the street level. And that's where Jerusalem is today. And it gives us an impression and understanding of just how many layers. I've been told there's 25 layers to the city of Jerusalem. And so you can kind of see something like that here. And so you go up those stairs, and you up there, and there's the street. There's street vendors there, and there's shops and everything like that. And yet you just go a little ways across the street, and then you can see there's stairs going back down on the other side. And it's those stairs there. Now see, this picture right here is on the other side of that street back in there. And so now they have found that pool, it used to continue to flow right down in here. And they say, this is where the fuller part of the pool of Siloam was at. These were the steps that led down into that pool. And they're continuing to excavate this. But the problem is there's buildings and houses built here all around it. You can't just go in and tear down somebody's house. Processes you have to go through to try to acquire the land and things like that to be able to build. There's a pipeline that comes right down. There's a drainage pipe. Draining from what? The pool of Siloam on the other side of the road. Years ago, how many years ago, they dug that thing through. I suppose not even knowing that right below the pipe they put through are these steps that went down into the pool of Siloam. It's like that all over Jerusalem. Well, in other places in Israel too. Where there are these treasures, these finds that are underneath buildings that have been there now for centuries. And so we're just looking at this just to kind of have in mind the fact that perhaps this is the pool where Jesus sent the man to go. And he came down these steps, down into the water, and washed his eyes.
Were these pools used for public bathing, or what was that?
You know, there were some that was more like bathing pools, and then there were some others that was not so much for bathing. And I really don't know if this was a bathing pool or not. I don't know.
A lot of them were used for ritual cleansing before they went into the temple.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's right, too. There is actually some pools for bathing that were heated even. And I don't think that was the case with this. And I've not read anything that says that. But I don't know for sure. But it is kind of interesting to me just to think that, you know, maybe it was here somewhere. And of course, I'm almost assuming that in that rock cleft or all that debris that's on the other side, someday in the buildings that are there, someday if that was all cleared out, I would almost imagine that down in here is the bottom of the pool, and there's steps just like this that go up the other side. And it's covered up by centuries worth of building that has been added on top of that. And so they say this is a continuing process. It'll be at least 20 or 25 years to fully uncover the pool of Siloam. But it's interesting too, they found pottery at this level down here. It's first century pottery, you know, that takes us back to that time. But is this where the blind man, in obedience to Jesus, was made to see? Just some things to think about. And trying to get our bearings and understanding the events here as it unfolds. Thoughts or comments that you would have?
Here. One thing before you move on from the miracle, and something Jesus says here, that this man was not born blind because of his sin. He was not born blind because of his parents' sin. So why was he born blind?
Mm-hmm.
For the glory of God. The fact that he's referred to as a man means he's got to be at least 20 years old, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And so for 20 years, this man experienced blindness for the glory of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lesson for us, that sometimes things we go through or deal with, we may not know why we're going through them and what's happening, but we can know that the end result can be for God's glory if we trust in him.
Yeah, I love that point. Sometimes we do face issues and trials and afflictions in life that we just cannot understand. You know, people say, why is this happening to me? And I would be careful not to want to say that, you know, God is going to cause affliction just so he can prove his point. Though sometimes he may use that. We know that. Did God cause this man to be blind just for this point? I don't know. I've gone back and forth on that. Or was the man born blind and God is just going to use it for his glory? Or did God cause the man to be blind so he could use it for his glory? I don't know how to answer that exactly. I'm not sure, you know. But could it very well be that God caused the blindness for this event? That could very well be what Jesus is referring to.
I think there's a difference between causing and allowing.
Yes.
As well, so.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah.
But even if he did cause it, let's assume that this man remained faithful until death. Or we can think about Lazarus, from the rich man of Lazarus, who we know was faithful.
Yeah.
If you were to ask those people today, well, was that physical thing that you, was that a burden for you? I have a feeling they'd reply it was a privilege.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, good point. All right. Interesting story, isn't it? I mean, as it unfolds, we try to understand different aspects of this. I want to deal again first a moment about the obedience here of the man. And even the idea of the term here of Jesus saying, you know, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And the man was healed. I mean, he came away from there with his affliction removed. All right. Is there something else that we can make of this? Is there something else that needs to stand out in our mind when we think about this event as it unfolds here?
I don't know if I would say that this is a full-blown shadow type of baptism, but there certainly are some similarities.
Mm-hmm.
This man received some instruction from Jesus, and he had to obey that instruction and carry it out to receive the benefit of it. when the gospel is taught to a person today, they're receiving instruction from Jesus, and they have to carry out that instruction in order to receive the benefit of eternal life. And just as this man did not receive his sight until he went to Siloam, we don't receive the washing away of our sin until we obey Christ in baptism.
Yeah.
So there's some similarities there.
I see that. I do. I think that's a point that stands out, that if we just read through kind of quick, we might miss that. You know, we need to think about that. Les?
The verse from 1 Corinthians came to my mind in regards to this. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Ordinarily, spitting on somebody would be a thing that would be, you know, in other words, it's spitting on the ground, making clay and rubbing it into somebody's face would seem to be a bad thing. But God does things because he is wiser. His ways are not our ways. His ways are higher than our ways. And whatever he chooses to do, Jesus seldom, if ever, treats a particular case in exactly the same way. And that's kind of a lesson for us who want to spread the gospel, who want to do personal evangelism, that it's seldom an exact science, in that the gospel message is the same, but people, individuals are different. And individuals require individual attention as to what their particular background is, what they know already, how they grew up, what their state of life is now, you know, what condition they're, are they in a third marriage, or, you know, what's going on with them. And so it seems to be a lesson. You know?
And that we may not always understand what God wants us to do. I mean, like, again, Naaman, go dip seven times. Why the Jordan? Why seven times? That's not the issue. That's not the point. It was about obedience. Why the clay? I have no idea about why the clay. Why the pool of Siloam? I mean, if they were at the temple, the other pool is not very far the other side. Why not there? Why the pool of Siloam? I don't know. I don't know if there's any significance to that. Or maybe they had walked down this way. I don't know. But the point was, go wash. And when he obeyed, there was relief. And so the point here and the significance of obedience just really is kind of just stands out here. Earl and Rick.
You mentioned Naaman. We don't know if he did or not, but it could have been that Naaman, he dipped the first time, and as he came up, went through his skin, and it's still leprosy. The third time he looked. Fourth time, the fifth, the sixth time he came up, he may have looked at himself and said, I still have leprosy. But I'm going to dip that seventh time.
Right.
Came up the seventh time.
Yes, it.
It's like you were saying, each situation is different. And why seven times? We don't know. Why the pool of Siloam?
Why not seven times in the pool of Siloam?
People ask the question today, why baptism?
That's right.
Just do it.
Because Jesus said, because the Lord said. Rick.
What does that obedience demonstrate? It demonstrates faith in what they've been commanded to do. It reminds me of Peter in the boat when Jesus says, you know, go out and cast your nets in the water. Peter says, Lord, we fished all night and we didn't catch anything.
Right.
But
at your will.
At your will we will do this.
And what about Ananias to Saul? Arise and go be baptized. Wash away your sins. Simple instruction. And do we always understand the why of what the Lord says? No. But it says a lot about obedience.
And Saul had been fasting and praying
for 3 days.
So if all you have to do is say a sinner's prayer.
If all you have to do is believe.
If all you have to do is believe. He'd been believing.
He'd been believing. That's right.
3 days.
That's right.
Still something else.
Obedience. Good thoughts. Good comments.